from the campus of Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington. You're listening to the G Suite Podcast, where we discuss all things Zag business.
Jabez Labrette is an executive in residence in the School of Business at Gonzaga University. His expertise spans marketing, finance, education, and entrepreneurship. In this episode, he discusses branding in the era of social media, and specifically Southwest Airlines' recent announcement to shift away from the business model it's long been known for.
Today, we have a special guest, one of our newer executive in residence here in the business school, Jabez Labrette, an alum. Were you, you were 2003, 03, is that right?
02. Yeah.
Glory years, close. Right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I should have been 02. I took a victory lap.
I should have stayed. I should have taken
Yeah, right, right.
What was I thinking? Yeah. Getting out of here.
But going to talk about, this is going to be a special edition because we're going to talk about some specific items that are happening in the news as of late. So let me try, Jabez, to kind of lay a little of the background, but correct me if I'm wrong. About a week ago, breaking news, Southwest Airline changing how they do business, right? Historically, a discount carrier did get some of the perks like picking a seat. I guess you could do some things where you could buy your way up to get on the plane sooner. But you could change your flight without a charge. For a while, I think they did pretty well with that business model. And then we saw that they were changing it up. I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, we have kind of a premium class now. Can pick your own seat. I think they're going to charge for bags. They used to not charge for bags. I don't know if they're switching their change fee or not, but how about you just, you run with that kind of background and correct me where I'm wrong.
No, you're spot on. It's interesting to see that, just over a week ago, the Southwest Airlines CEO, went to TikTok to make an announcement that they were no longer going to be allowing bags fly free. Under the guise, he said, quote, this is Bob Jordan, the CEO, on a video telling customers why they're going to start charging for bags, that it's for the level of profitability that we all expect. And I just don't think that really hit the mark on when you're telling people, yeah, I know we've been helping you save money over the years, but we all expect a higher profitability. If they were hurting for revenue, they could have said, hey, we got to make some changes, tighten up the belt a little bit because we want to stick around. We want to still be in business. But to phrase it in a sense that's like the customer is also a stakeholder in the profitability of the business was rather tone deaf. And it's on the heels of a lot of changes. I mean, you talked about the seat selection as one of them. That was about a year ago they announced they were going to do that. And they're now getting to the implementation of that. You know, you see a brand that was built on accessibility, affordability, and niceness.
Right.
And that's really what Southwest stood for. And that was, 30, 40 years ago? I mean, like 30 years ago? They've been around for a while. And it was way pre-social media, pre-internet really being a ubiquitous part of our day-to-day life. And so fast forward to today, and I think they're operating under old methodologies of market approach, and they're getting slammed.
Well, and the way you describe that, or the way you're sharing that statement, it makes me think of every other carrier who, when fuel costs go up, they start charging for bags. And then when they go away, we're still going to charge it for bags. Profitability, right? And I guess that unique, hey, we're actually on your side, we're not gonna gouge you for everything at Southwest, I guess it's not working, right? Or somebody decided something, right? Because that's where they're going. Do you know anything about the founder? And I can't place his name.
Bob Jordan. Oh, the founder.
The founder,
of Southwest.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Southwest was not, it wasn't the first business endeavor from the founder. The founder, you'll have to pull it up. I can't recall his name, but I do know that the backstory was the idea of building a regional airline that ran more efficiently was his big thing. Was it, you know, get basically Southwest in the airline business is known for keeping their planes off the ground.
Yeah, Herb Kelleher, does that sound right?
That sounds right.
There's a Roland King too.
Their whole entire vision, and it really was the Southwest had started and then it got taken over. The guy who purchased it is the one who really made it into Southwest. He was trying to buy a regional airline, and their efficiency of wheels up. We want our planes in the air. That was the business model side of it.
Yeah.
We want our planes in the air. The more time we're in the air, we're moving people, the more profitable and money that we're going to make. Yeah. And we're going to cut down on all of the extra perk stuff. Like, we're just going to make it kind of a no frills. You got to get from point A to point B. Make it a nice experience.
Yeah.
Be good service. Be a good service based company. And then, you know, let's go. And it worked really well. For a very long time, obviously, for decades. They were crushing it on their numbers.
And great fares. I remember when I was younger, like skedaddle to Seattle for like $69.
It was crazy.
I'll go to Seattle for $69. I mean,
yeah. It was absolutely nuts. They'd figured out a new business model that was different than your traditional Deltas, Uniteds, American Airlines, you know, who were really banking on the business traveler who's not as concerned about the cost of the ticket, but more concerned about the convenience. And I want the lounge and I want the first class upgrades. And I, you know, I'm booking whenever, you know, I work for IBM and it doesn't matter. I just book a week out. Who cares? We were billing it to the client anyway. That was the Delta Airlines, American Airlines customer. And Southwest said, well, there's all these other people that have to fly. And they don't want all of, or necessarily need all of those things. And right. They certainly don't want to pay extra for their seat in the back of the bus, if you will, to cover the cost of all the extra perks for everybody else.
Right, right.
And so they filled a really important niche, but they begin to become synonymous. The brand became synonymous, not just with being a low cost provider, but they anchored in. They did this. They anchored in on bags fly free, sit wherever you want. They did that. They had these banners at the airport that would have like a suitcase like screwed to it. And it was like, I fly free. And it was like this 12-foot tall, like sign that says, it's the luggage speaking to me. And the luggage is saying, pick Southwest because I fly for free. If you're doubling down that hard on something like baggage going free, you can't just about face out of nowhere and say it's all about profitability, so we have to do this.
So is it, and I think unequivocally that's poor messaging by the CEO by that statement that you opened up with, but what's going on? Why the shift? Is it just pure profitability, or is it so let me, if I think, okay, all my bags fly free, or was there a limit to them?
There's two bags fly free.
I mean, were people taking advantage of it to a point where, I don't know, maybe there is an additional cost there. Everyone's got huge bags. We're loading up, then we've got our carry-on and our personal item, and it's crowded up front. People aren't having as good of an experience. Or what do you know about the background of why the change, why the shift? Is it just simply bottom line?
Yeah, I mean, your cost on your airline is weight. Weight is the cost, right? It's how the more weight you have, the more fuel you use to get from point A to point B. And that's a huge, huge bit of the cost. I mean, you have to rent your gates at every airport that you land. You have to pay for the gate space. Right. You have to pay for your pilots and flight attendants and, you know, crew and all that and food, you know, but the weight of the plane is a huge, huge, not the biggest factor, and bags weigh something. I mean, there's a limit. I think it's 50 pounds or whatever. Okay. You know, so they did have some limits to prevent people from overly taking advantage of it. Estimates are billions of dollars. I mean, this is going to be billions of dollars in profitability. And you mentioned it earlier when the fuel prices went up in the early 2000s.
Yeah,
and the airlines were like, "Oh man, golly, geez, you know, we really wish we could not charge more, but we're going to have to charge you for bags." And right. and we hope it doesn't last that long. And I was like, no. The moment they start charging us, they're never taking that away. Yep. But that's a whole nother gripe and issue. That's an economist needs to come in here and talk about that. I think that the problem isn't that Southwest is starting to try to look like the other airlines, because they're now really kind of becoming a baby Delta.
Okay.
Like, you no longer get to pick your seat. We're going to have premium seating. Pretty soon we'll probably see first class seats installed at some point in time. We're going to start seeing more meal options, probably paid options, you know, and we're going to start seeing them begin to morph into these other airline models. And that's okay. It's not that is a problem to do that. I think you are allowed to change direction as your company grows. The problem is, I think really, they thought they had control over what people think Southwest Airlines is in a way that they clearly, evidently do not. And that's your brand. I mean, your brand isn't the logo you slap on or the catchphrase you put on your thing. Your brand is, what do people say about you behind your back?
Right.
That's really what your brand is. What do people say about you when you're not in the room? And they had lost control over what people were saying about them, so much to the point where people were like, well, yeah, it's cheap. I sit wherever I want. And my bag, I don't have to pay for bags flight. I mean, that was just the three things that people cared about most.
And when you say they lost control, elaborate on that a little bit. I mean, what was it that, because it certainly started out for them a very positive, unique market niche. Did they lose control with this announcement or prior to the announcement?
I think that in my view, what we're seeing is a representation of how companies and organizations writ large have lost the ability to really control brand in ways in the last 10 years or so that we didn't see for the last entirety of history of all of business. Okay. You know, you rewind the clock back to the, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, what you're seeing is companies coming out and having the ability to say, where am I going to put my messaging? What is that messaging going to say? And how am I going to choose to interact with the consumer in a way to, you know, further advance my brand?
Okay.
Then the internet became popular and accessible. Computers became accessible at home. Mobile devices adopted computers, and then social media came.
Yeah.
And that all happened in a really short amount of time. And in that process, what happened is organizations, companies were still operating under the same old principles that guided them to where they had gotten here today, kind of like a founder's dilemma. They were like, well, this is how you do branding. This is how we do market positioning. This is how we communicate to our customers. And then all of a sudden now you can scroll through the CEO's message is buried under tens of thousands of videos that came out within minutes of their announcement of their consumers talking to their consumers, their customers talking to their customers in real time about things that are happening to this company. And they were pretending they could just get on and the CEO could just make a 3-minute video message. And then everybody's going to go, golly, you know, I really appreciated that. And I really connect with what he's saying there. And you know what? He must be right. You know, he knows best. And he's like, well, you know, we're still about service and we're still about this. And I'm not saying you're not, but I'm saying that you think you have more control over it than you really do.
Interesting. And it seems to me, and social media is, I guess, the next big iteration of that. And not only that, people aren't even going to traditional channels at all. They're just staying entirely on there within their algorithm, I suppose. And if things get out of control, you know, your perception is drastically different.
That's massive echo chambers. And you're seeing these echo chambers. So the media post, you know, 80s, when they started making changes to the way that we regulate media, clicks and sensational news has become all that really mainstream media is.
100%.
And I think everybody, politics aside, can agree that we've got kind of a little bit of a broken media environment. That tends to lead itself to echo chambers being something easy for the media to grab onto because it's quick, sensational, and it's got momentum behind it. And so you take social media, now you're seeing media reporting on social media, like they're like about the story through the social media messaging that's happening there. That's not even, they're not reporting on the journalistic deep dive side of it. They're saying users on TikTok or Facebook or, you know, Twitter, I can't call it X for the life of me. But, you know, the users online are disgruntled or talking about this or, you know, look at all these people that are not necessarily qualified to be talking about these issues or sharing significant opinions. And then those opinions are ending up on Fox and CNN and all of those media outlets, even NPR. And the ones that I think try to still maintain are still embedding videos from social media as source material to talk about what consumers are or are not thinking. Whereas before, we'd have to wait until the next quarterly, you know, 40 years ago, we'd have to wait till the next quarterly finances were released to see if there was the earnings call to see if there was any impact on the decision that the company made one way or the other. And that didn't even give us consumer insights, really. You know, we had to do surveys, and who's going to do a survey? Who wants, what am I going to go survey another company's consumers just to find out how pissed off they are?
Right. And now what's happened to Southwest in this, I guess, week and a half? I mean, a stock dropped. I mean, obviously, there's a big social media explosion. What are some of the other backlash other than just everyone kind of pissed off?
The big unknown right now is it going to actually impact people buying tickets?
Okay.
That is going to ultimately be the test of where does this decision land and how does it impact the business?
Right.
You know, what we miss in these conversations sometimes is the opportunity cost is hard to calculate because let's say profits continue to rise. Now we have to start looking at, okay, well, if profits continue to rise after unpopular decisions, did all airlines profits rise? Did all airlines revenue rise? Are we traveling more? And so therefore their profits, they could have had even more profit, but they didn't get that extra piece of profit they would have gotten because these people went to another airline or decided not to fly. It's hard to capture that data point of who decided not to fly.
Right.
And so we get in these not as easy to define outcomes. Situations with these sorts of things. What we can say pretty clearly is that there's been a series of decisions made by this company that have not been popular. We've seen that with other companies. Facebook, for example, has made quite a few decisions over the last several years that have not been popular, and that has impacted their amount of users.
What are some examples of those?
Well, first side, Facebook was heavily moderating content. Heavily. This is a great example because I think it shows two sides. They start heavy-handedly moderating content and just really piss off a certain group of people.
Yeah. And then I'm guessing you're referring to maybe more conservative Trump supporters.
Yeah. So it was that really heavy lockdown on this isn't fake news or that isn't real. And it was predominantly leaning into the Make America Great side of the fence, that culture piece.
Yeah, affecting
those users.
Okay. Yeah.
Those users got mad and all wanted to leave or left. Then Facebook did an about face recently and said, well, we're going to moderate anything. Yeah. It's all open. You know, we're not in the business of moderation. That's not what we do. So it's all. And now the other side of the fence is getting mad. And I'm like, well, you just can't. You're not bringing back the ones you lost 4 years ago because now you're not moderating content.
Right,
and now
right.
You're losing people who enjoyed the moderation, who are the ones who were left over. And you kind of scratch your head at like, why are these sorts of decisions being made? Facebook's decisions on how they've updated their algorithm have not been very popular. The way that they've been selling data has become unpopular. People are like, well, wait a minute, what are you doing with all of my data? Yeah. Like your Cambridge Analytica is a great example. You know, Facebook knew what was going on there. They knew when they gave Cambridge Analytica the access to the data, that that was potentially opening up some user data that wasn't meant to be shared.
Yeah.
And then when they found out about it, they didn't actually stop it. So they let Cambridge Analytica keep the data and they said, give us the data back, please. And then they didn't for a while. Then they did give it back. And then they were like, oops, I guess we didn't. And then Facebook figured out they hadn't really given it back. And so they just kind of like, they could have put a stronger effort in to have recovered users' data that wasn't meant to be going to those people, and they didn't. And that's a decision. They chose not to take action in that case. And those things have, I think, you know, disenfranchised their users.
Yeah, and remind our listeners of some of the details of Cambridge Analytica. It was doing analysis of data for political groups, right? And was it during around...
Yeah, so Hillary it was Clinton Hillary was Clinton was running. Psychographic analytics are very powerful. Okay. If I get enough users together and using empirical criterion keying, for those that are data nerds or stats nerds, I can take seemingly unrelated data points and come to conclusions about user behavior and what somebody's likely to do. The famous example, that's the Minnesota Multiple Personality Index, the MMPI test for mental disorders. And it asks questions like, do you like strawberries? Yes or no. Do you like cloudy days? Yes or no. And so it's like hundreds and hundreds of questions that seem to have nothing to do with anything, but maybe it turns out 98% of people who have schizophrenia like strawberries, prefer cloudy days, don't like blues. Like there's these weird correlative ways to use that data that you can come to like some significantly confident decisions. Okay. That's what Cambridge Analytica was doing on politics. Okay. So they were put out these little, like, and we've probably all done them, these surveys that are like, hey, find out what kind of cartoon character you would have been in the 1980s by filling out this questionnaire. And so you'd click yes, and then you'd answer 10 questions, and it would be like, you know, oh, you were most like Shaggy, you know, or whatever from Scooby-Doo.
Sure.
And then everybody'd have a good laugh about it, and it was kind of funny. All that whole entire survey or test thing was for was in the terms and conditions. When you click that you're going to do that, it says that whoever owns that gets access to all of your data.
Wow.
It has nothing to do with, they don't make any money off of the test,
right?
The silly test that tells you you're Shaggy from Scooby-Doo. They make money off of all of the data they get because Facebook allows them to take all of your data.
So that survey's on Facebook, let's say. They go to Facebook and say, we have a waiver here for all these users. Give us this data from that kind of deal. We're talking clicks and likes and posts, probably analyzing what you put in a post, I would imagine.
Absolutely. So, sentiment, tone, words, location, all of the info, frequency, pictures, you name it. So that's one thing. That's you taking the test.
Yeah.
What Cambridge Analytica did, which was went one step further and took data from other people you were connected to that didn't take the survey.
Oh, wow.
So they never said they consented to have their data taken. And it was that data reach that is in violation of Facebook's terms and conditions as a business who's offering products on Facebook. You're not supposed to do that. And so in doing that, they had stepped one step past terms and service conditions, but Facebook didn't throw the book at them and put the hammer down.
Interesting.
So you've got a company acting nefariously, taking data they shouldn't have, absolutely should not have. But that opened up the data pool immensely.
Yeah. I mean,
they got way more data by exploiting a vulnerability within Facebook's ecosystem. Facebook figures it out, turns off the vulnerability, but doesn't go back and say, hey, but you can't keep that person's data. I know they didn't give it to you, but they just said, please don't. It was a very soft, I mean, they said don't, but like they didn't do anything. So you can say stop it and give it back, but
sure,
if you don't make them give it back,
then right,
it's not likely to happen. And turn to find out, they said, oh yeah, we gave it back. And then they didn't. And like years later, it came out, they hadn't, and they were still using all the data.
Yeah.
And they were still targeting, you know, in this case, they were targeting information campaigns, you know, for politicians with fairly good effect.
And so, and they want more likes, more echo of certain viewpoints. So the person using whatever the social media is has a perception of, oh, this is, everybody wants this, or this is popular, or this is a good idea kind of thing.
Yeah. So what Cambridge Analytica was doing was leveraging that data to produce content and then putting that content in front of the people who either really, really, really wanted it or really, 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 really hated it.
Interesting.
Because interaction is what gets you movement in social. The brand problem here is that Facebook, over the last while, has really thought that their brand stood for the place where people come to connect. And it's just not anymore. And they still think that it is, which is fascinating because social media is kind of what decentralized brand control to begin with. So the irony of a social media platform thinking their brand is above the very thing that they helped usher in is kind of fascinating. But Facebook really does seem to think, and you get that in listening to the way that Facebook as an organization, and in their case, predominantly Mark Zuckerberg, right, is the one who does most of the talking. How does he talk about Facebook? And how does he talk about the users of Facebook? And you can tell that there's a disconnect between the way he thinks people, why he thinks people are there, and what he thinks Facebook stands for, and what people are actually using Facebook for, which is no longer the place where I go get all of my updates,
right,
from people that I haven't seen in a long time.
Right.
You know.
Right. And not dissimilar from kind of our main focus, I suppose, is Southwest Airlines, right? What the CEO says and what's actually happening, right? A disconnect there.
Yeah, there's a significant disconnect in the way that they think they're going to be able to. They think they're navigating a ship in the waters of consumer interest, and they're not anymore. They're not just at the helm of the boat and they can just decide we're going to go west and the boat goes west. It is not how it works now. There's so many different factors impacting what people are thinking a company is. And that does eventually translate to more or less revenue.
So a rudderless ship, let's say that. And maybe that's not the
a ship with too many rudders.
Many rudders and a lot of storms, right?
A lot of storms.
Back to Southwest Airlines. So you'd mentioned earlier they failed to realize that they lost control of messaging. So if I'm CEO of a company, we'll say Southwest, what measures do I take to at least get some level of control over my messaging or what I want people to perceive my product to be about?
Certainly user-generated content is really powerful these days. So organizations need to get better at finding ways to engage their user base, particularly their fans. These aren't necessarily influencers, but you want to start with your fans. Who likes you a lot? And you need to be positioning what you're doing or how you're navigating your waters, if you will, back to the boat, in a way that invites those people to be a part of the conversation. And there's a big difference between inviting people to be a part of the conversation and letting them make the decision. You don't have to let them make the decision, but you certainly do want to get those stakeholders involved and involved early. Companies are waiting too long. They're making decisions in back rooms that are, I get the need for confidentiality and timed rollouts and making decisions fully before they're public. Like what if the conversation behind the closed doors was, well, do we have one bag for free, no bags for free? Do we charge $40? Do we charge $60? Like you need to have space for those conversations that are not public, because you can't just open up every option out there.
Yeah.
However, we tend to, in business, make a decision and then do it. And I think we need to build in some more time between decision making and actual implementation. we view implementation, the speed to implementation, as a huge factor in just our growth, right? So we think of growth, part of growth, as speed to implementation. I get an idea, I get a plan, I vet the plan, I decide on the decision, and then I should implement it as fast as possible. We need to add some steps into that. One of those steps being to create an environment, a place where we are able to engage those that are our biggest fans to be a part of the process of that communication. That's from a comms perspective. The other side of it would be go to kind of like an IDEO Stanford design thinking model, where I think brands and organizations need to start including more consumers in the decision-making process. If nothing else is duck and cover. Like, at worst case, that is, well, we did engage people and collectively we decided to do this. So it's no longer person from on high just determining this is the thing that we're going to do. It really reframes decisions away from that kind of, I'm the king of the company and I just decide, to, well, no, I invited people to the table and we had conversations. But businesses hate doing that, and it costs money and time. I mean, and they can't stand spending the energy to make that happen. I mean, not all companies, but most.
Sure, sure. Particularly when you have pressure from investors and you need to move the needle. How might Southwest have done that in this situation where, I guess we'll take the CEO at his word. This is a revenue, another revenue opportunity, right? So we want to move forward. How do you?
Yeah. One great step would have been to have done a blind focus group situation where you don't say who the brand is or the company is and don't give away any indicators of what that, like if you said, oh, what if bags fly free? Like you'd have to really pull back on the information, but to convene a group of people and make them some inner industry people, make them some consumers and have some conversations about it and just say like, hey, what would you do if you were in this situation? What are some things you might consider doing? Then you can take that information, because I think that most people, if they looked at the raw numbers, would say, well, I think there's an opportunity over here to maybe help the company from a profitability perspective. Sure. And I think if you ask people, hey, the companies want to make sure they don't go underwater, you know, obviously it's a competitive market and they need to increase profitability, people will find their way to that answer pretty quickly. Sure. In something non, this isn't new. Like you don't need a degree to know, to see that. Like it's pretty obvious.
You're in business to make money, right?
Yeah. Some level, right? And so this isn't something technically out of reach for folks. And so you bring them in and have some conversations. And then when you go to the next level of conversation, you can say, well, based off of our last conversation with a group of people, they came to a conclusion that maybe we should be doing this. You are Southwest people. How would we implement this? If you were to do it, how would you implement it? And I'm always surprised. We used to run a high school, and yeah. I was always shocked at the creativity and answers that I would get
right.
from like a 14-year-old.
Right.
And I was like, I honestly would not have thought of that. I was like, and you know, kids are the same way. Like you look at your kids and you're like, man, that is just, I just wouldn't have looked at it that way. We need more of that in the conversation, and that's going to help the company ultimately either make the decision, or maybe they've already made the decision kind of in their head, but it's going to help them get better buy-in and craft better messaging. Because then what you're doing is you're no longer saying I am in control of all of my messaging and brand, and you're literally admitting I need input from our consumers and, you know, the people who work here, to make sure that I am able to include that in what it is the messaging around who we are.
Right. So it's almost like, you know, forgetting about a key stakeholder and clearly not getting their buy-in when you make these decisions from on high. Do you know anything else about that, the decision for Southwest? I admittedly have not read up on it or anything, but obviously there was some backlash. Have they come out with subsequent statements?
They haven't really. They just did some layoffs. So I don't know. That's one way to come out with some statement to kind of cover up the bag thing with layoffs. But those are two such dramatically different things that impact very different people in different ways that they have not, and they haven't reversed course. I don't think that reversing course is out of the realm of possibility. Consumers have and people have pushed organizations to reverse course on things that they thought they were going to do. And companies that were like, well, we're going to implement this. And people were like, yeah, but I really, really don't like that. And I really liked this part about what you're doing. And the company, you know, said, you know what? We made the decision. It was the right decision for the right time, but we've decided that maybe we need to change, relook at that again. Will Southwest do that? I don't know. I mean, the don't get to choose where you sit thing. Yeah, it was okay.
Yeah.
I mean, was that making a huge difference in your travel experience? Yeah, it was unique. It was okay. But charge me an extra $100 to check two bags or $150. Wow, on my already $165 fare, like suddenly that becomes significant. Right. And it no longer, so that is a much, 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 much bigger decision than just you don't get to sit where you want to sit. And I think people are willing to say, all right, fine, we'll let that one go. This one they're really mad about. Now, is that anger going to be enough to get the CEO to decide to change course? I don't know.
Suppose if revenue,
I guess we'll find out. Yeah. I mean, if revenue drops, then yes, they can go back to their stakeholders and say, hey, you know, their shareholders and say, hey, you know, we tried it, bad idea. We need to change direction. But it ekes of shareholder directive. Yeah. Like that, this has it written all over it. Like, I don't believe that the CEO, I'm sure he has, you know, incentive bonuses. Most of the CEOs of companies that size are doing very well.
Yeah.
And yeah, the incentive bonus is a lot. And I'm not saying that those people turn down big chunks of money, but this one really did feel like it was just a shareholder meeting where the biggest shareholder said, hey, we're leaving $4 billion on the table. Go fix that. And then they just did it.
Yeah.
Yeah, at least that's what it feels like.
Yeah,
and I'm not. Yeah. I haven't obviously been in those rooms, but
right. Well, I mean, I think if you're reading between the lines on the statements, I mean, it's pretty hard to come to a different conclusion. You know, it's funny when I think of Southwest for me personally, right? Probably before I had kids, I would have been I'm all about that, right? Yeah, give me a cheap fare. I don't care. I'm younger. I can handle a little tighter seat. Get me there cheap, up and down. I mean, I can. I guess I might pack a bag, but I might just have my carry-on. But I probably haven't flown. I mean, I flew it recently just because it was the only direct flight. But I would kind of avoid that as I've, you know, if you, particularly if I had kids, because I'm worried about not being able to sit next to them. Right. I mean, I suppose you could always ask people, but or pay to get moved up to, you know, between A1 and A15 or yep. Whatever the order of getting on is. But I can certainly see the different market niche that they were playing to. And as you say, now they're just, you know, if these things come to fruition, right? And what's the timeline on that? What are they saying?
They haven't released it. No. So there isn't a definitive timeline. I think they had originally said, oh gosh, I want to say May, something like May something. Okay. Where they had come out with a date, and then I heard that they were thinking of adjusting the date, but that, so they're working on that part,
yeah,
of the exact date. But it wasn't long; it wasn't like 6 months from now we're gonna do this. It was like, no, we're gonna do this pretty quick. Like, this is gonna be like a month and a half, 2 months. Yeah. Like, we're rolling this out. We're just letting you know right now we're rolling this out.
Yeah, and maybe honestly, maybe it was gonna be in pieces, right? Because I guess one thing they have to do is you got to put premium seats in somewhere, so you gotta.
Yeah, so they certainly, all of these changes aren't happening at the same time. They are stage rolling out certain decisions in different orders. What you bring up about the kid thing is a really, really important, I think, layer especially from a brand and messaging perspective, is, you know, I'm also a parent and I also wouldn't book Southwest out of the same fear unless I'm going to pay to get myself up closer to the front, just or front of the line, just to ensure we can sit together. Right. And we've only got one kid. You got more than one kid. Like, it gets real complicated real fast.
Right.
And that I may not be your number one target customer, but I was 15 years ago. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like you said, oh, no reason to, why not go to Seattle for the weekend? That sounds fun.
Yeah.
You know, so like I was in a whole different place. That consumer that will say, we'll just say under 35, likely not without kids, not necessarily, but probably, or retired,
right,
and kids are out. Right. So let's, you know, on fixed income on this side or whatever, and on this side, I'm not.
Yeah, there. You and your spouse don't want to sit by each other anyway. So
yeah, so you're like, oh yeah, we've been sitting next to each other for 45 years. They and so they get this, you know, idea that they filled the market. Like we talked about earlier, that was a niche that they addressed. They found a pocket of people who needed to have a certain kind of experience and service and at a price that was approachable. And we're going to go for that. Now, how are you becoming any different than Delta Airlines or American Airlines or United?
Right.
Like, how are you? I mean, I feel like Alaska Airlines is the only good airline left, you know, after this. Like, you know, I love Alaska, but they're traditional.
Yeah.
I get my seat. I get my, like, so they're becoming all of those things. And now you're just another airline. And maybe they looked at the, maybe they looked at the numbers and said, well, we don't really care if we piss off a few of the 25-year-olds and a few of the 70-year-olds. There's a swath in the middle that should, would be attracted to the things like picking your seat and premium options and right, this and that. And they don't really care about bags, you know, paying for a bag or not, because they might have availability to those funds. I can't get out of my head that Southwest Airlines is a discount airline. Like, just because you do all those things doesn't magically change, and you tell me that you're something different.
Right.
Doesn't change for me what it is I think about you. I still think that you're that, even though you may not be
right
anymore.
Right.
So how fast are you going to capture my,
right,
unless you're doing something different? And from the sounds of it, they're not doing anything different. They're just starting to do everything the same as everybody else. So I don't understand the differentiation that it's going to attract this new market. All I see is a bunch of people upset on different sides of their market that are mad about the decisions and not happy, and that are now thinking to themselves, you didn't just do something I didn't like. You did something that's going to impact my economics.
Right.
It's another layer. And you know, they thought that their brand of good service, when you listen to the CEO's response, part of the tone of his response is, we're still that company that you came to love, that's fun, that provides just a nice, comfortable environment. You know, we do the fun things with the announcements on the security, this, that, and the other, and we're fun, and we're good service. We're a good service-based company. That's great. I don't think anybody's disputing that. I don't think that's what people were really buying you for. I think that was icing on the cake. People still fly Spirit. despite Spirit having the worst flight experience of all, and they're not nice and they're not fun and they're nothing. They're
sardines,
like a sardine, yeah, in a can to, yeah, get you from point A to point B, and people are still flying them. Southwest thought that their brand was customer service is priority, and we're fun and we're nice, and I that wasn't actually what their brand really is playing out to be.
I wonder if this move is maybe in a response to the intro of Spirit, and then over the years of Spirit's taking that market share that they historically, or at least at the beginning, Southwest kind of was the only player in that market. I don't know, I'm just speculating. I don't know if you know anything about that, but I mean, are the consumers that are seeking discount moving over to a Spirit better deal? And all of a sudden Southwest is kind of in a unique position of not your cookie cutter Alaska, United, Delta, American, but not that discount carrier.
They got a little flanked a little bit on the discount carrier side, Spirit, Frontier, you know, some of those other smaller regionals as well. Another factor on top of that is that they have aging infrastructure in their IT. They had a huge IT outage a year ago that impacted bajillions of flights.
Yeah.
That is a massive capital expense that they're going to have to bear. And they've got an aging fleet.
Interesting.
And you look at a Spirit airline can come in and build from the ground up an IT infrastructure to run the whole thing, which these are complicated. You know, it's complicated to run an airline. And it's probably cheaper to build it up and maintain that than it is to take your legacy system and migrate it. Anybody listening to this who's ever been a part of a migration knows how awesome that is. It is horrible. And so they're staring down the pipeline at two very, very, very big, costly, expensive. There's going to be mistakes that happen. There's going to be things that don't work well in the transitions of these things. And they're probably going, man, where are we going to find the money to stick around for 20 more years? And can we do that? I don't know that I think that the decision to start charging for bags was wrong. I think that where they messed up is in how they communicated it and how they what they think their brand is compared to what I think that their customer thinks their brand is.
And what is that disconnect between what do they think versus what's their customer think?
I mean, the Southwest Airlines thinks that they're reliable and fun and good customer service. The consumer thinks that they're reliable enough and cheap.
Yeah.
And so.
And don't gouge me with.
That last part, you don't nickel and dime me. Like the Spirits of the world nickel and dime everybody, right?
Okay.
You have to pay an extra $5 for this. You know, you want water, it's $2. You want to put a bag up top, it's like $25 or so. I don't, like, everything's got a cost. I thankfully I've not had to fly Spirit.
I've never flown Spirit.
I plan to hopefully avoid having to do that. But I get it. I mean, I've certainly been in a situation where if Spirit was around, I absolutely would have flown with a backpack and the clothes on my back.
Right.
No question about it. And so I see where they're filling their marketplace. Southwest thought that they were the good service. We don't nickel and dime you like that. And they don't see baggage as nickel and diming. They see baggage as like, imagine that you're sitting back and you're looking at the actual cost of things and you go, well, a huge expense, because I'm looking at our P&L, a huge expense of ours is these bags that we're not charging for, but we're carrying them. And we carry this many tons of bags every day. And that tonnage has a direct cost. Like, I used to be a financial analyst. That was stuff I used to nerd out about. I was like, how much does it cost to move a ton of this stuff per mile?
Right.
And I would have had an exact number and I would have said, oh, well, it costs $364 per ton per mile. And we fly this many miles and this is how many tons we have. And I would have been like, look at how much money we're spending on moving bags for free. You know, if we just charged a little bit for those, we can not only recoup the cost, we could break some profit. That's a conversation that would have been my job to have had in the finance world. Like, to say that was what I should say.
Right.
That's my job. The problem is when they went to the consumer, they didn't bring all that background with them. They didn't bring all that conversation with them. They didn't necessarily bring it. What the consumer heard is, we know we used to give you something for free and we don't anymore.
Because we want to be
profitable. Because we want to be profitable to the level of profitability that we all expect.
There you go. We all expect.
And so, yeah. So it's not a surprise that it fell flat and is caused a bunch of turmoil for them. And it's just another example of when we become too reliant on what we think our brand. There used to be this really old adage in the computer world that nobody gets fired for hiring Big Blue, which was IBM.
Okay.
And the idea was that if you hired IBM, you're not going to get fired. It may not be the best decision for you to make, but at least you're not going to get fired. And IBM rested on those laurels for a little too long. And then companies like Oracle and other, you know, other organizations came in and realized, oh, IBM is resting at the wheel right now because they're still thinking that people are just worried about not getting fired when they're making these decisions. We're about helping companies become profitable and be able to take advantage of this new technology, like, you know, when WebSphere and stuff for IBM is coming out. And so you find yourself in a similar situation where they thought they knew what the customer believed and wanted, because way back when that was true. And instead of constantly reevaluating what your brand really is, you just, I get it though. I mean, I see where that happens. You just get complacent.
Sure.
And you're like, this is what we are.
Sure.
And then you don't reevaluate that. And I'm wondering, like, you know, to people listening right now, has your organization reevaluated what your brand position is? Not what you say your brand is, but what do other people really think about you? When's the last time you actually went out and did some research on that? You might be kind of surprised.
Yeah. So what would, you know, if I'm leadership in a company, what's my process of reevaluation, periodic reevaluation of my brand? Am I doing something like those focus groups you talked about earlier? What's a good methodology for that?
Yeah. I think that net promoter score on some aspects of your business can be helpful. So that's the, you know, would you recommend this to a friend, 1 to 10? You know, that sort of, like, surveys can get long and laborious, and I don't think they're incredibly effective. NPS does still work, I think, in getting some insight into how people are feeling about things. So that gives you a little bit of sentiment feel. Certainly some focus group in inclusion of your base market to find out what do you think about us? What changes do you think we've made? What information do you think we should, you know, maybe doing a actual survey of even your non-customers. Why don't people buy from you?
Yeah.
You know, and you know, you go all the way to Gallup or all the way down to the mom and pop, you know, survey folks. But, you know, maybe doing some amount of that would be interesting just to start to paint a little bit of a clearer picture for you. You know, and I think that you can, and you can also run some data analytics on social media. What are people saying about you? Good, bad, and ugly. And then bringing that, you know, scraping that data into a way that you can begin to then start sifting through, looking for common traits and common sentiments can give you, you know, this is the hard thing about brand. It's squishy. It's not an easy data point like, oh, I had a visitor on my website or I sold a widget for a dollar. It's super like, well, what are people thinking? How are you feeling about me?
Right.
And we get really uncomfortable with that because we feel like if we can't define it with clear data, that it doesn't mean anything. But it clearly does mean something, even if you can't define it with a super clear picture, but there still is something there.
Yeah.
And that something can help drive how you make decisions, when you make decisions, and where you make decisions in ways that I think do have direct bottom line impact.
Interesting. We're just about out of time. Is there anything that we didn't cover that you would want to add to the conversation?
I don't think there's anything that we could have covered more. I thought it was great. And I appreciate the opportunity to get to talk about it because it just was so timely in what was happening.
Yeah.
And it was just so like, it just happened right now. And we haven't even been able to see what the actual outcome of it is going to be. But it just brings up that whole bigger point of maybe we've lost a little bit of control of this part of our businesses.
Right.
And maybe we need to do some things to try to kind of like recapture information.
Yeah.
Because the control's gone. It's never coming back.
Yeah.
That's not happening. But now can I go out and get info and data where I can that can help shape the way that I make and navigate the decisions moving forward?
Yeah.
I think is a really cool opportunity for organizations. And those that do it well are going to find it easier to make decisions down the line.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you coming in. You have a book.
A couple, but none of them are really that exciting.
Okay, none of them are that exciting.
Okay. No, most of my books are in the legal profession. So
in that arena, huh?
And they're in technology, which means they were outdated the moment they hit print.
Yeah, I know. So. All right. Well, thanks again, Gilbert Labrette, joining us. It's been a real pleasure, man.
Thank you.
This podcast has been a production of the Gonzaga University School of Business Administration and was edited by Colby Verhoeven. Thank you to our host, Professor Andrew Brasich, and thank you for listening.